Welcome, ladies, gentlemen, and peanut butter enthusiasts. Welcome to another episode of The Coneheads Theory. I am your co-host, Chris Fabian.
I am your co-host, Stephen Lacey.
And I am your co-co-host, Chris Thomas.
And I wanted to kick things off today by backtracking a little bit. Last week, if you remember, we talked about actors who had moved from comedy to drama and actors that had moved from drama to comedy. And among this particular group, I think it's most grievous that we forgot to mention Mr. Albert Brooks.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
A comedic actor who took a fantastic turn in Drive as the villain Bernie Rose.
a fantastic turn for the dark and ominous and just unsettling, I would say.
Sinister.
And here's hoping that the Academy recognizes that come awards time. But Mr. Thomas actually has seen a movie this week that he'd like to talk about a little bit. Lars von Trier's new opus, Melancholia.
Yeah, I went to go see it the other night. It was kind of tough because Take Shelter, the new Michael Shannon movie, was also playing, so it was kind of a tough call. And it's kind of funny because I did what I almost always do, is I always check Rotten Tomatoes just out of habit. Like, I see what people are saying and what kind of, you know, what's going around.
Right.
And Melancholia is, let me put it this way, that is not a film that you can judge by the tomato meter. Like, the tomato meter is not much help because true to form with almost all of Lars von Trier's films is that it, views on the movie are extremely polar. You know, people either seem to love it or they hate it. I haven't heard really much middle of the road about it. And I see why. Melancholia is, I don't really quite know how to describe what it's about without spoiling anything.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding that you pretty much know what the movie's about in the first 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So, I think that if you talk about the premise, you're not going to shock or upset anybody. I mean, I think if somebody's going to see a Lars von Trier movie to begin with, they kind of know what they're getting into.
Right.
So, and again, the fact that the ending happens before the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
I wouldn't worry about, like, somebody who's going to be like, oh, there's a spoiler.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you mention that, actually, because I went to go see it with my girlfriend, and we showed up late.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget that at Terrace, I don't know if they always do it like this, but I don't think they showed any trailers, you know, so there's no real margin of, you know. So we showed up late, and we missed the first chunk of it, and so we missed the overture,
you know,
which is, basically the end of the film, in the beginning of the film. But it's sort of a series of... I forget the actual name of the piece, but it's a series of really gorgeous slow motion scenes, sort of symbolic of the movie itself and literal scenes from the movie, set to a Wagner piece from, I think it's Tristan.
Tristan and Isolde.
Isolde. And so it's sort of set to that. It's really gorgeous, but yeah, like I said, I'll get to that in a second. We missed that initially.
Okay.
And so we kind of came in, and I got to say, like, I'm kind of glad for it, but not necessarily that I think it would have been I would have enjoyed it less, but I don't know how I would have seen it had I not really seen the ending, you know, right off the rip. So there was sort of that... I didn't really know what was going to happen, so it was kind of like, and from what I've read, according to von Trier, that's why he placed that at the beginning, is because he didn't want audiences distracted by what they thought might happen. Because the basic premise of the film is that there is a planet called Melancholia that's headed straight for Earth. Meanwhile, on Earth, the movie opens with Kirsten Dunst getting right after her wedding, and her brand new husband, played by Alexander Skarsgård.
No, Pe-
Peter Sarsgaard.
No, Alexander. It's Stellan Skarsgård's son.
Okay, it is Alexander. Right. Sorry. Yeah. Okay.
Who actually, Stellan is in it as well.
Okay, nice.
Alexander Skarsgård plays her husband, and it's basically their kind of reception, you know, post-wedding celebration. One thing that was really interesting about the film is that it perfectly balanced extremely visually stunning to the point of I've actually heard a lot of people call it pretentious, which I'm kind of like, thank God. Like, I kind of like artists who kind of go, especially Von Trier, who goes so pretentious.
Right. I mean,
that
he's
like breaking ground with that.
if you look up pretentious filmmaker in the dictionary, there's a picture of Von Trier, and he's probably giving you the finger.
Sure. But, yeah. I mean, it's uber ambitious visually at times, but at the same time, the scenes of dialogue follow zero rules rhythmically.
Okay.
There's nothing traditional about the way that the scenes are paced. I read some reviews that mentioned that the film was tedious, and I thought that was kind of curious. And when I went to go see it, I completely got what they meant. Because Von Trier isn't pandering to the audience. Like, he's not necessarily trying to please you. In a lot of ways, the film was challenging, like all of his movies are.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that. The first, well, really the only Von Trier movie I've ever seen all the way through was one of his really early pieces, maybe his first movie, which was called Zentropa. It might be credited as Europa also. 1991.
Criterion picked it up.
So, yeah, so Zentropa, or Europa as it's referred to, it's post-World War II. It's a story about an American ex-GI who takes a job working for a railway company in Europe. And it turns into this whole, like, sabotage thing with, like, former Nazis, and it gets really weird, and it's got very stylized kind of imagery. And it was one of those movies where I watched it, and I thought that it was just fantastic, but I wasn't really sure exactly what had happened. And there's this narration by, I want to say, Max von Sydow.
Nice.
That kind of doesn't really make any sort of sense. Like, it's just this weird. It was kind of one of those things. Again, we're watching it. I was like, I know I just watched something awesome. I don't really know what I just watched.
Right.
But I'm pretty sure it was awesome.
His movies kind of have that. They definitely have that effect on me. Antichrist. I was definitely kind of like, I feel like I just got hit by a Mack truck. Yet I want to thank the driver.
Right.
One thing I can say about Melancholia is that it uses beautiful, it straddles the line between literal and metaphoric, you know, literal and symbolic, because, and this is my own sort of perception of it, and I'm just going to go ahead and say spoiler alert to be safe, because this is just kind of my interpretation of something, but that's, you know, in the movie, but, you know, to me it kind of had this metaphor of just sadness, that this planet, you know, was just kind of like depression,
right?
You know, it just this infinite sadness, and that it's, you know, basically how the different characters, the primary characters being played by Kirsten Dunst, who plays Justine, then Claire, her sister, who's played by Charlotte Gainsbourg, and then her husband, who is played by Kiefer Sutherland, I can't remember his name, and they all sort of deal with this in different ways. The knowledge that this, you know, this big planet is headed towards Earth, they all kind of deal in their own ways, you
right.
know, and so it's, you know, it's pretty interesting on that level. To me, it definitely, I've always been a fan of art, especially with music and with film also, where you can sort of, it's, I don't want to say vague enough, but it's sort of,
open-ended?
Kind of, yeah, it's, yeah, there's room for metaphor, but there's room for interpretation. It isn't like this is literal. Although that's kind of strange to say that, because in this particular case, Von Trier does literally put these circumstances in front of you. It's done artistically, but I mean, it's done pretty literally. There's a lot of shots of the planet in the sky and getting larger, and there's even a scene where Charlotte Gainsbourg, her character, is kind of the one who is just in fear. Who is like panicking, and we're all gonna die? Like, you know, And she's kind of looking up Melancholia online and, like, reading about, like, theories about it hitting Earth and you know, fuck, I don't even remember my point. But, yeah, this.
Well, I do remember reading something about this movie and specifically about, you know, like, I guess there was a – somebody was critical of the science and saying, you know, there's this would not happen for this, that, and the other reason. And there's and Von Trier went on record as saying, yeah, that's not – it's supposed to be a completely implausible plot because that's not what I wanted to do. And I'd have a lot of respect for him as a filmmaker where he's kind of not concerned with being scientifically accurate. He's concerned with telling a story. Yeah. And again, I think that kind of is, again – to take it back, what I really liked about Zentropa Europa was that the story, again, didn't make a whole lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're trying to watch it following a specific narrative of beginning, middle, and end, and this happens and that happens and so on and so forth, you're just going to be upset.
Sure.
But for just a pure artistic endeavor, it's pretty brilliant.
Sure.
I mean, and it's literally been years since I've seen it, and yet I find it just extremely memorable.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say it almost seems like the things that are seemingly literal, albeit implausible, you know, like you were saying about the, you know, how people had a problem with like the implausibility of it. It seems really that although it's laid out sort of literally in the film.
Mm-hmm.
What the real focus of the film is the people and
right.
their reaction to this situation. So it's like almost like Sunshine,
okay.
Whereas the film Sunshine is an example of where everyone had. I remember when that came out, reading reviews and how the scientific community had, you know, there's
all kinds of issues.
Right. There's no way you're going to reignite the sun with a bomb. You know, the bomb would have to be, because supposedly the bomb they have in the premise of that film is in the near future when the sun is beginning to go out. They send a crew into space. The first one actually gets lost, and they
right.
send a second crew with a bomb the size of Manhattan Island.
Well, I don't remember if it was the size. I think it was the density of Manhattan Island.
Gotcha.
But it was this whole thing where with the, you know, like for the first bomb, for the first ship that they went out, that they sent out and the first bomb, like they used half the world's supply of uranium. And
mm-hmm.
so the second ship that goes out, it's the other half. So it's basically this is the last chance or they're screwed and they're trying to escape an ice age and so on and so forth. But again, yeah, I see what you're saying, that with Sunshine, it was much more about telling a good story
mm-hmm.
and an entertaining story than it was with maintaining a strict scientific accuracy.
Yeah,
which,
it's not a scientific
But having said
document.
That, there was a lot of scientific accuracy in the film.
Mm-hmm.
It was just that was not the focus. But again, you can look at a movie like Sunshine and talk about how, well, it wasn't scientifically accurate, but then you can say, oh, yeah, but, you know, fucking Armageddon and you know, Deep Impact, those were...
Sure.
Those were, you know, 100%
spot on,
you
and
know.
And I mean, the key to me, what's kind of the primary focus to me is on the people. That's
right.
like really the most, you know, the key element is like how these people are dealing with being, in Sunshine's case, you know, trapped in close quarters with each other. Really, everything starts to go haywire because of a human error. The one guy messes up his calculations and they're doomed. You know, they realize none of them are going home. And so,
right.
you know, seeing them deal with that and him kind of deal with having made this mistake and how, you know.
Well, and I remember one of the things that I feel like the company that marketed, I can't remember who released Sunshine, but I remember that they felt as though they were having trouble figuring out how to do the marketing on it because of just because it was such a kind of an unusual film and it was like, and I remember that one of the later marketing campaigns they had was everybody dies. And that was like,
right.
And I will say the first, I mean, so I'm not spoiling anything because if you look anything up for this movie, it will tell you everybody dies.
And
I remember the first time I watched the movie, not knowing that was the case and thinking to myself,
I think it was, Fox Searchlight put that out.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Well, Fox not knowing how to market a movie, there's a big shocker.
Is that was that post Slumdog? That was the one.
No. That was pre.
That was pre-Slumdog.
That
was the one before.
That was the one right before it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I remember watching the movie, and you know, I'm thinking to myself, man, this looks like it's building towards your standard. You know, oh, we had a crew of people, and everybody one by one is getting killed off, except for, you know, conveniently enough, the two romantic leads. And just like, I was like, man, if this movie ends with them somehow figuring out how to, I'll be really, really upset. And then it didn't. And I was like,
right.
Well, all right. I thought to myself, you know, if anybody has the balls to kill off all their characters, it would be Danny Boyle. But there's no way that's going to happen. I stand corrected. And so I thought that was really kind of a, and if you're listening to this podcast and you have not seen Sunshine, it's a fantastic movie, and the fact that I've told you that everybody dies in no way will, I think, will lessen your enjoyment of the film. Because it really is. It becomes – the thing that makes that movie awesome is it becomes about something bigger than just life or death of a single person.
Right. And it's funny that you mentioned that because we were actually – you mentioned the mishandling of the marketing or the lack thereof, you know, knowing how to market that film. Because we were just talking, like, you know, at the end of – I think it was last podcast about, like, you know, mishandled marketing.
Right.
You know, films that sort of – some films are mishandled. Some you just – they just kind of do what they can with a movie that you can't really market. It's funny because I saw Antichrist. I think it was it came on one of the channels on cable. It was like IFC or something.
Uh-huh.
And the description of Antichrist was like, you know, couple dealing with loss of child goes to cabin in the woods and, you know, antics ensue or something.
Right.
You know, they confront their
wacky hijinks.
You know, but I mean, it wasn't that. It wasn't literally antics and soup, but it was something of that nature. And it's just, you know, on the one hand, I was like, wow. I feel for the dude who thinks it's going to be something simple or something, you know.
Right.
But at the same time, how else would you pitch that? Like, I mean, really, it's kind of literally what that movie's about, you know. So
yeah, Antichrist is the only Von Trier film I've seen. But, yeah, it's pretty rough. But I think you're absolutely right, Chris, about Melancholia being about depression because I saw an interview with William Dafoe, who played him, the lead in Antichrist, and he said while they were making the movie that Von Trier, there were days where, like, he just did not want to come out of his trailer even because he was going through this really serious bout of depression.
Right.
And so I think Melancholia may have been
almost
kind of
like his
catharsis almost.
Yeah. He's spoken on that. There's actual YouTube videos where it's Lars von Trier on depression.
Oh, wow.
Where, and his – I mean, to put it simply, his solution is just keep working. That was like his cure that he found.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Wallow, if you could – I feel like the gap between Antichrist and Melancholia as far as release years goes is much shorter than his usual.
2 years, 2009 and 2011.
Right, and then before that, as far as actual films.
In case y'all didn't hear that, Antichrist came out in 2009. Melancholia is a 2011 release.
Oh, so okay. He's got a pretty. Yeah.
All right, then I.
He stays busy.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I was under the impression it wasn't quite like a Cameron-esque, you know, production cycle where it's 15 years between movies.
Yeah, like one. Yeah.
Or
he had actually Von Trier had actually said that he got the inspiration for the film via a revelation he had in therapy, where his therapist told him that. People who battle depression react to stressful situations more calmly, I guess, because they always – I mean, they already kind of – it's just built in that they kind of expect the worst, so they don't you know, panic as much. And so, I mean, kind of like I said earlier, is this film very much dealt with these three main characters – really four, if you count Charlotte Gainsbourg and Kiefer Sutherland, who play a married couple, if you count their son, because his role in it, in my eyes, was very important. Like, his sort of perception of the whole thing and, you know, his innocence.
And this kind of brings up an interesting question that I had about do you feel that foreign directors that have a name in the United States, you know, people like Von Trier or I guess if you want to go...
Michel Gondry.
Gondry.
Terry Gilliam.
No, he's American.
Gilliam's an American. No, he's
a British expatriate.
Yeah, he was.
I am not talking Borat about Jan de Bont. Okay.
Oh, well, technically, The Room, what's his
Tommy
face?
Wiseau.
Well, Tommy Wiseau. Tommy Wiseau. He is a foreign auteur.
Well, that's
albeit
gray
we
area.
Have no clue where he
which brings up a point. I have a crazy theory about The Room.
That he's a Klingon? Oh, what? Go ahead.
No. I was looking stuff up on The Room the other day just because it's, you know, hilarious.
Like a car wreck.
And it made me think, like, what if the whole thing, like everything, like the intentionally bad film and all of it and just the crazy cult status? Because I read that that Tommy Wiseau is really interested in psychology. What if it was just like a giant psychological prank? Like the right. whole thing. Like yeah. he just, what he wanted to do was see if he could make a terrible movie and just market himself as a weirdo and market the movie as some kind of who knows what.
Right.
And turn it into a cult classic. Like, which, yeah. if that's the case, bravo.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, he makes Andy Kaufman look like, I don't know.
Rosie O'Donnell.
Yeah. Thanks.
Why not?
yeah.
That's yeah. the weirdest analogy I think I've ever heard, but okay.
Yeah.
Well, real quick, what was the point you were making about foreign directors?
Oh, just it feels like a lot of foreign directors who have kind of strange visions or specific filmmaking styles, like they get accepted a lot more for their strange. Like everybody knows that Von Trier is kind of a lunatic, and you know, if anything, over the last couple of years, he's sort of refined his talent for putting his foot in his mouth,
sure.
especially when dealing with the press.
Which we were kind of talking about that on the way over here, as far as like Von Trier's, like I wonder how much is just straight up deliberate. Like
right.
it's just you
I
know.
Think there's quite a bit of that actually, because they released cast posters for Melancholia, one with Charlotte Gainsbourg and one with Kirsten Dunst, Kiefer Sutherland, Alex Skarsgård. And there was one that had Lars von Trier on it. He's the director. He's not in the movie. But it was done up just like the other posters. And in the corner, it has the stamp of persona non grata from Cannes Film Festival. for those of you not familiar with Lars von Trier and the movies we're talking about, you know, as Chris was saying earlier, his movies are very difficult to watch, typically. Antichrist was extremely graphic, extremely strange, and just it's challenging cinema. I think Von Trier actually said he believes that movies should be almost like a rock in your shoe. It's something that sort of bothers you and doesn't go away. But he's also known for making some pretty insane statements in public. He, at the Cannes Film Festival this year, he went on this rant about being a Nazi and sympathizing with Adolf Hitler. And I believe we actually have a little bit of that for you right here. So I will turn it over to Mr. Von Trier.
But anyway, I really wanted to be a Jew, and then I found out that I was really a Nazi, you know, because my family was German, Hartmann, which also gave me some pleasure. So I'm kind of a, yeah.
So
I what can I say? I understand Hitler.
Oh my God. fuck.
But I think he did some wrong things. Yes, absolutely. But I can see him sitting in his bunker in the end. But there will come a point at the end of this. There will come. I will. No, I'm just saying that I think I understand the man. He's not what you would call a good guy, but I understand much about him, and I sympathize with him a little bit. Yes, but come on, I'm not for the Second World War, and I'm not against Jews. Susanna Bier is no, not even Susanna Bier. That was also a joke. I am, of course, very much for Jews. No, not too much, because Israel is a pain in the ass. But still, how can I get out of this sentence?
By another question.
I am
here's your salvation.
I just want to say about the art of the... I'm very much for Speer. Speer I liked. Albert Speer I liked. He was also maybe one of God's best children, but he had some talent that was kind of...
All right. I think we...
Yeah, so, I mean...
Wow. That's...
One of the things that was so funny about that, besides what he was saying, Kirsten Dunst is sitting right next to him this entire time and looks absolutely mortified. And... She's doing her best to not crack or punch him in the face or something. But.
Or have her head, like, pop off the top of her body. Like, she literally looks like she's just, like, you know, yeah, I'll come out. I'll work with Von Trier. It'll be great. My career will do wonderfully.
I think we're going to have to put this we've got a still up on the screen where we stopped the video, and the look on her face is priceless. We'll have to post that on the page for you.
On that note, though, this is easily the raddest performance I've ever seen.
Oh, nice, nice.
Virgin Suicides was probably my fave up until this point. But, yeah, she's 100% on this one, man.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think she's honestly suffered at all from this. I think that, you know, people...
Hell, she won the... grand jury prize at Cannes.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, or not. Is it the grand? It was like the best actress. Grand jury, I guess. I'm not too familiar
That's
with
Sundance. Well, I don't know. I know. What
I think
you're
grand
saying,
jury though. Is like best picture or something. I'm not sure quite.
No, the best picture at the Cannes is the Palme d'Or.
Yeah.
I never had a Palme apostrophe, you know. Oh.
The Palme d'Or.
Yeah, just best actress, yeah, for her.
But here we are trying to complicate, and it's just, you know, they're like...
Best actress.
Okay, wait, in a French accent, best... I'm not even going to try it.
Best actress.
All right, thank you, Mr. Voices himself, Chris Fabian.
Also nominated at the European Film Awards.
For Melancholia.
She's cool. a talented lady.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if any of you are looking for something... definitely against the norm, something a little more challenging. Lars von Trier would be the filmmaker of choice, I think.
Yeah.
Just be warned, it's like I said, Antichrist is the only example that I've actually seen myself, but it's very intense, it's very graphic. I won't go into any more detail than that, but...
I saw one of his called The Idiots... that was, I think it was shot entirely on, like, video. Like, not digital, but, like, straight-up video.
Wow.
I think so. And it had, like Antichrist, it had full penetration.
Whoa, what?
Yeah. Straight up. Yeah. There's an R version and an unrated of Antichrist. And it's, like, right in the opening. It's like in the opening love scene in the shower, yeah. And it's like, I don't think it's really Defoe and Gainsbourg. I think they got, you know, like stunt cocks. But,
we would have accepted stunt doubles.
The Idiots is part of his, he did what was called the Golden Hearts trilogy. Which
right.
I think
we talked about not too long ago, which was...
The Idiots,
Dancer in the dark, and Breaking the Waves. Yeah, which I guess I have seen Dance from the Dark, which after that movie, I literally wanted to go jump off of a building and get hit by a train and then, you know, drown afterwards. Like, it was just easily one of the most
bleakest films.
Depressing films I've seen, just because of.
Well, that's something that's basically the common, because the trilogy, the films aren't related in anything other than the theme that it's I don't know how to put it, good women being persecuted ultimately,
right.
and finding liberation, I guess, and finding salvation in different ways, I guess. The Idiots was definitely a bold flick, and it was a toughie. It was a tough one, and it's all in Danish, I think. It was like subtitled,
mm-hmm.
But it's basically about a commune of a woman that falls. I forget why she. I think she goes through a divorce or for some reason gets persecuted by her family, and falls in with this commune of people that go around and pretend they're retarded, not to be mocking, but to experience freedom in public, like freedom from all their like kind of. What's the term for it? Like social kind of hang-ups and like, you know,
taboos? And
sort of, yeah. Like these like social constraints,
right,
of, you
okay.
know, what's expected of, you know, they just kind of go in public and can sort of act, you know, however they want because it's under the guise. And everybody around them truly thinks that they're, you know, that they're. But like I said, it's a full-on von Trier move, you know, because,
right.
you know, it's on the one hand, people can get outraged that it's, you know, it's mocking or it's making light. But it really doesn't. It's actually, in my opinion, it was a really beautiful film. And it was
okay.
It was definitely worth the watch.
I think it just goes to show. You know, I sort of agree with what von Trier said about cinema, not about Hitler.
About you need to make that
not about Israel.
it doesn't always have to be entertaining or fun.
Hold on, time out, real quick.
I think that cinema can be challenging sometimes, and that it's in a way a good thing to sort of challenge yourself in that way.
Sure.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I agree that movies do need to be challenging, and not every movie that you go to see needs to be a happy-go-lucky, feel-good, you know, hug-it-out kind of movie. But by the same token, I think that there needs to be a balance between, like, you know, kind of like the bleak sort of cinema.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, our entire last episode was about Hugo and the Muppets.
Right, absolutely.
So, yeah, really.
It doesn't get any more the antithesis of bleak than that.
Right, fair enough, right. Fair enough.
I am I'm grateful for von Trier, though, because I'm glad somebody does that. Like, I'm glad that somebody just, like, for example, Dancer in the Dark is hands down the bleakest film I've ever seen.
Right.
I've never seen, I mean, in all of its implications, everything considered that happens in that movie, and ultimately its outcome is... The bleakest cinema, like, movie-watching experience I've ever had, hands down. I don't know anybody who could watch that and not want to stick a pistol in their mouth the second the screen goes black and it
right.
says directed by Lars von Trier. But I respect his art. I respect that boldness, that unapologetically bleak. I think art needs that a lot of time. I think, you know, that I'm glad that somebody's there to do that, to... Sometimes it's just bleak, and there is no – we're used to somehow seeing some kind of hope or some kind of something that sort of justifies whatever darkness there is, you know, like even The Exorcist, you know, in the end, you know. If you haven't seen it, just go see it. Watch it. It's a classic. Like, I'm sorry, I'm going to spoil it. But in the end, when they drive the demon out and she survives and it's all for something. And
well, I mean, and even, you know, even the fact that Father, is it Father Karras?
Yeah. Well, which one?
The
younger priest.
The younger priest.
Yeah, yeah.
Who dies, but he's been having his crisis of faith.
Yes.
And then regains his faith and finds, in regaining his faith, the strength to, you know, save the little girl and sacrifice himself, which is what's so important for the story is that it's and it be and it kind of comes full circle. So even in a dark, you know, terrifying movie, you know, you still kind of have that glimmer of hope.
Yeah, there's some kind of like contextual reason for, you know, the darkness.
Exactly.
Not so much in Dancer in the Dark. There is, but it's, I guess it's just a little more. Actually, you know what? I haven't seen it in a long time, so I don't want to comment too specifically. But I'll put it this way. I was grateful for having watched. Afterward, it was like, wow. You know, and I was affected.
Right.
You know, Melancholia had that effect. You know, I noticed, you know, afterward, it wasn't like, you know, everybody wasn't like shuffling out gleefully. It was people were just kind of like,
wow.
You want to go get some coffee?
Well, I mean, it can be just like it may have been for Von Trier himself making the movie. It can be kind of cathartic seeing something like that and just sort of contrasting it with your own life. And it's almost that sort of thing where you sort of look at yourself and go, well, I don't really have it all that bad now, do I?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just a good way of putting your life and your own human experience in context of what could be. Even if it is just the worst case scenario, you know, portrayed on screen. But it's what art and cinema is there for. It can, you know, give you an experience like that where you grow as a person almost, or it can just be something to waste an hour and a half and put a smile on your face or whatever it may be.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Well, I mean, and yeah, absolutely. Well, and one of the things that I was thinking about was there's a director who I found that I really like his stuff, and he's only made a couple movies at this point. But and it's really funny because he's also an actor, and kind of gets typecast in movies and TV as this kind of, I don't know what the word would be. He's always just kind of a dick. His actor's name is Thomas McCarthy. He was in, do you remember in The Wire in the fifth season, the reporter who started making up the story?
Yeah.
Yes,
absolutely.
And that's kind of the characters that he plays. He always kind of plays this supercilious and sort of like just snarky asshole. And it's really weird because he's made three movies so far. He's written and directed, and it's, The Station Agent, The Visitor, and then Win-Win, which came out this year.
That's the Paul Giamatti?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the thing that just blows me away is, you know, like he's typecast as playing these dick characters, but then the movies that he makes are these incredibly warm, heartfelt, touching stories about just people. And it's not, you know, it's not anything extravagant. It's just... it's about people making connections. Is honestly, like, all three of his movies, you could boil it down to people making connections. And I think that I find it very odd. You know, it's like, you know, I can't figure out, does he have, like, this, you know, this interior life where he's like, I'm not really a dick, and I play one on TV all the time, so I need to make these, like...
kind of like Bob Saget having to go as dirty as possible to compensate for a...
for Full House.
And America's right. Funny, yeah.
Right, right, exactly. I was thinking about that because I was thinking about Win-Win as being one of the movies that would probably make my top 10 this year, that came out earlier and I'd kind of completely forgotten about it. And then the other day I was like, I heard somebody talking about it. I was like, I did see that movie. I really like that movie.
Did you already make the point with, the foreign directors?
Just how their weirdness is a little more accepted over here?
Pretty much.
That's probably, I mean, not to be cliche and not to put anybody down, but I think that as Americans, just American audiences in general perceive Europe and just, I guess, foreign filmmakers and foreign films as being something of some sort of exotic, something different, even though, you know, that may not necessarily be the case.
Well, I mean, a perfect example, I think, of is look at Drive, you know, which was the director is Nicholas Winding Refn.
Refn.
Refn, who's from, is he from the Netherlands?
He's Danish, yes.
Oh, from he's Danish. And so he made this, you know, kind of this perfect, like, action movie that was still a very independent action movie, mm-hmm. and was very quirky, but it was still accepted as being, you know, like a great piece of cinema. And so I think that there's a – I totally do not know where I was just going.
Well, I think what it is that maybe on the flip side in Europe, maybe there's a little more room for creativity and room to do things that are a little more out there, a little more against the grain. And I say that because, you know, in the United States, there's, you know, you've got the big six, the big studios that kind of control most of what gets put into theaters. And
right.
It's a little more calculated over here because the number one export of the United States is actually our intellectual properties.
And interesting.
So it's a little bit more of a business decision, whereas, you know, European studios, they don't have to have such a wide appeal to make back their budget or to
right.
do well for their studio, because, you know, the studios over there are going to be distributing American films.
And I think they even have, like, tax breaks where you know, even if your film bombs, you get, like, half of your money back or something. That's literally how Uwe Boll continues to make films.
Really?
Uwe Boll.
There's a German tax write-off, or I don't know if that's the right way of putting it. I'm kind of ignorant to, like, the whole taxing process. But there's a German tax break, I guess, that even if your film plummets at the box office, you still get half of your money back.
For those of you who do not know who Uwe Boll is, he is the man that's responsible for every bad video game movie you've ever seen. Alone in the Dark.
Other than Super Mario Brothers, which is actually kind of cool, and Street Fighter. I think all the other ones.
Super Mario Brothers. Have any of you ever seen Bob Hoskins talk about that movie?
I just read an interview with him talking about
every
that movie.
Every single time somebody asks him about his career and if he would change anything, he always says, "I would never have made Super Mario Brothers." He absolutely despises the fact that he was in that movie.
A friend of mine told me that movie prophesies 9/11.
What?
There's a scene where they're in, I guess because it's in like a kind of, is it in the future or is it like...
No, it's an alternate reality.
An alternate reality. And the towers were like half... masters, or they were like, you know, half up or something, because I guess it was like maybe something post-apocalyptic or something. I don't know. My friend Brian told me about that. We can totally cut that if y'all want. But anyway, what do you call it? something that I was thinking about is that I feel like in maybe not even that long ago, maybe about like 5 to 10 years ago, there were kind of more quirky, I'm thinking about American like closer to indie sort of directors, like
right.
Wes Anderson or
Rodriguez.
And I feel like their reign, I feel like lately there hasn't been very much of that. Like they've been sort of like, I don't know about marginalized or if they just haven't made a film in a while or what, but I feel like
who's particularly you talking about? Just
like Paul, not as much Paul Thomas Anderson, because he was sort of major right out of the gate. I just feel like
was it There Will Be Blood?
Yeah.
I thought he made one more recently than that. But
if he did, I'm not aware of it. I haven't heard about anything.
Ladies and gentlemen, for some reason, we've just completely lost our internet, so we can no longer look stuff up. So now we're going to be flying by the seat of our pants.
Cool.
We're officially back in the early 90s.
We know our way around cinema well enough.
I don't know. I guess all I'm making in this, I mean, this is, you know, not the most, like, informed opinion, I guess, but I just feel like, in recent times, I haven't heard much about quirkier, kind of more indie-leaning sort of American major releases. Whereas, like, in about, like, 5 to 10 years ago, I feel like there was just more, like, more in the cinema.
Right. No, there definitely has been a trend in the last few years kind of away from...
It's been more, like, 3D and blockbustery and, like, a lot of, like, computer anime, like, kids' movies. And there have been some great flicks. Like, Drive is a beautiful example, and
right.
it, you know, it definitely had like blockbuster-ish properties without ever becoming one. There was not one millisecond of that film that felt like trite or money-making or dishonest, or, you know, it just, you know, was awesome.
Right.
But even foreign films now, they just remake them. Like, there's not even, like, a real, like, I guess they release them, like, domestically here, but, like, even foreign films, like, they just kind of, like, remake them for American audiences. And
well, yeah. Well, and one of the things that, like, I was actually having a conversation with Mr. Wallow earlier today, and we were talking about how it feels to me as though over the last few years you've seen a shift in the filmmaking industry kind of away from quirkier, more dangerous, for lack of a better term,
yeah,
stories and properties and so on and so forth. And oddly enough, you started to see more quirky stuff happening on television where, you know, if you think about it, like, you know, the idea of doing a show like 24. Okay, we're going to do an entire day over the course of a season.
Right.
Completely, you know. Like, it's one of those things where, it, you know, when they came up with it, it was like, duh, how come nobody's thought of that before, and yet nobody thought of it before?
Right.
You know, or a show like Lost that, you know, absolutely, you know, demands that you pay attention to what's going on. Or a show like The Wire, which is the same way. You know,
current season of television's got some strange ones, too. There's Terra Nova, which is, you know, a time-traveling dinosaur survival kind of thing. And then Once Upon a Time, which is
the fairy tale retelling,
right. And then there's Pan Am, which is like Pan Am stewardesses from the 1960s.
That's, is somebody really major producing that or something?
Not Pan Am,
that's
on ABC.
Is it? But I'm like a film director. Is like Spielberg?
No, you know, it's Spielberg is the executive producer on Terra Nova.
I feel like Pan Am specifically had somebody.
John Wells, I think, is the name of the guy who did. He's the guy who did The West Wing.
Okay.
Him and so basically, Aaron Sorkin is the man behind The West Wing, but one of his co-producers, creators was John Wells, and then also Thomas Schlamm, and I think that he's directed a couple of episodes of Pan Am.
Nice.
And then you have Jonathan Nolan, Chris Nolan's brother, and J.J. Abrams collaborating on Person of Interest. That's
okay.
The show with Jim Caviezel and Michael Emerson from Lost.
Right, right.
Who is Michael Emerson in Lost?
He plays the leader of the Others, whose name escapes me at the moment.
Oh, dude.
He was
Benjamin
Linus.
Yes.
Yes. That's one of my favorite characters. Awesome. That's cool.
Yeah, but I don't know about that. I mean, to say that there is a trend away from quirky and kind of risky in cinema is kind of to not acknowledge, like, in the, like, last year, for example, we had Kick-Ass. There was Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And I mean, yeah, it was a remake, but even
no, they weren't. Neither one of them were remakes. They were both based on comics.
Yeah, graphic novels.
I know that, but I was saying, Let Me In.
It was
a remake. Was kind of, I mean, it still felt like it had some Euro kind of.
Yeah, sort of. Like I said in, I think it was last podcast, is that the special effects in that film definitely Americanized it. But I see what you're. There was a lot of space in that film.
Yeah, it was a very slow, you know, kind of thoughtful movie, and
almost
then,
quiet.
Right, right. And then there were these bursts of just like insane, intense violence and things like that. So I mean,
and to be clear, like, that's kind of why I like prefaced it with like, this isn't the most like informed like observation, because it's like it's one of those things where I'm just like, is it just me or?
Well, there's a lot in recent years that I think have been, I don't know, moving towards that trend. I mean, Fantastic Mr. Fox was, I mean, for a kid's movie, it was
awesome.
Very sophisticated.
But I mean,
it was not at all traditional. It was that stop motion, very old school
kind of. But I mean, again, that kind of going back to what we were talking about just a minute ago, that was Wes Anderson. And you kind of have to expect that from Wes Anderson, that he likes to, you know, like, the thing I love about Wes Anderson is, you could take me and lock me in a room for 2 years and then wheel me out and put me in front of a movie screen and start a movie and have no credits and nothing to tell me who made the movie And if it was a Wes Anderson movie, I would know it was a Wes Anderson movie literally in the first 35 seconds.
For sure.
It's just, like, even his early work is utterly, completely recognizable as being
awesome.
His stuff. Like, and that's, and so, you know, Wes Anderson, I think of it, is a quirky filmmaker, but that's also, he's a very, what's the word I'm looking for? He's very identifiable in his quirkiness.
Sure.
And it's gotten to the point where he's, you know, because it's identifiable, he has a following, and people will go see his movies.
So what is then? I guess I'm not following what your point is then. If you think that there's been like a shift away from quirky and risky, and because
that was pretty much you nailed it. I mean, that was kind of what I was like semi observing. It was more just like, what do y'all think? You know, because it was like, I feel like in recent times it has been. What I've noticed is, I guess the whole like, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to fucking edit that out. But I think you pretty much nailed it. Something I just wanted to say really quick that kind of pertained to like two things that we were actually talking about it in the car. It's like directors whose films have a look and then remakes. Is that I actually was talking to some friends who were commenting that they were sort of apprehensive about the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo American remake, because they thought there was just sort of the notion that like, oh man, like, you know, I really loved the Swedish film, you know, because it had such dense atmosphere and such this kind of oppressive vibe that that maybe Hollywood would kind of miss the mark and sort of make it into like kind of like a thriller, like kind of action movie. But the most important factor in that equation to me is David Fincher.
And absolutely.
David Fincher, that is a director who has a look. And if there is an American director who knows atmosphere, whose films have atmosphere, is David Fincher. Like, he is, to me, he's the perfect. I don't think they selected him because, I mean, there's definitely because he's bankable, but I don't think that's the only reason that they would have selected him to direct that particular film. I think it's because he's really one of the only directors I can think of.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I heard that David Fincher was helming the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo remake, I was like, my initial reaction was, okay, it was, hey, they're remaking Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Oh man, yeah, David Fincher's directing it. Cool,
nice.
It switched that fast. It went from being just the most ridiculous thing that anybody could tell me to, you know, good. If you're gonna remake a movie like that, you give it to somebody like Fincher, because he's gonna knock it out of the park.
Which is funny, because me and Faves were talking about this in the car on the way over. Is that, you know, you often hear like, oh man, they're gonna ruin it, and it's like, no, unless they go back in time and undirect the original, they can't ruin it. The worst case scenario is they make a weak film, and
right.
What? You still have the Girl with the, you still have the original, like, you know. It's, you know, there's they can't ruin it, you know.
Yeah,
that's really how I feel about remakes in general. I just take them as they come along. I mean, sure. I think that there should be, I think the trend should be more to remake movies that were done in the past but weren't very good. Maybe movies that had like a strong concept but it wasn't executed just right.
Right.
If we're going to talk about that, then I think we need to talk about one of my all-time favorite movies, which was a remake, and more specifically was a remake of a film that was more known for the behind the scenes stuff than for the actual film, which would be Ocean's 11, which incidentally this last week just celebrated its the 10-year anniversary of the remake
Soderbergh version.
And the thing is, the original version, I mean, yeah, it's a lot of fun, and it's the Rat Pack running around being the Rat Pack, but as far as movie stories go, it's not that good. You can really kind of tell that it's not, you know, Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. and Peter Lawford. No, not Peter Lawford. Yes, Peter Lawford. And Joey Bishop. That's the, yeah. It's not them really playing characters so much as just being themselves on camera and having fun with it. But the whole thing about it is the story was just kind of meh. And, you know, what I liked about the remake was that you could tell that Soderbergh wanted to tell an entertaining story.
Yeah, for sure.
And then and you know, Ted Griffin, who wrote the screenplay, came up with a really tight thriller. Even though one of the things that I really love about it is that the actual heist part is completely impossible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just I feel like there's this there's people that they get outraged when they hear a certain movie is being remade, and I mean, I understand where they're coming from to an extent, but at the same time, I mean, times change, and like we've said before, you know, the same story can be told in a million different ways.
Right.
You know, even, and remakes is not a new phenomenon. If you go back to Greek dramas thousands of years ago, they literally... You know, there's definitive versions of the stories that we know from that era, but they often were not the only version of that story.
No.
There were lots of... my brother's a little more of an expert than I am, but
right.
There's definitely a lot of, you know, remakes and reboots, if you will, of,
sure,
like, the same stories.
Right.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, and I just, you know, take them as they come, and... Sometimes it's better than the original. Sometimes it's not as good as the original. But ultimately, I think you should just watch it as a movie. Is it a good movie?
Yeah.
Right. Well, and again, you know, like the thing I really liked about the remake of Ocean's 11 was the whole heist sequence, I felt, was just a much tighter story and just much more, you know, kind of tense and enjoyable and you know, all the different elements. And I really like that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and just kind of piggybacking on what Fabes was saying about just stories being told and retold, it's like, you know, yeah, truly, like, what harm does it do, really?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, and a lot of times, they, like you said, just sort of judge the film on its own. A lot of times, they, like, for two that come to mind that could have been viewed poorly, but just sort of stood very well on their own, and they're both horror, is Dawn of the Dead and Fright Night. We're both super rad, like on their own, as their own sort of, you know, they had the same title and sort of dealt, you know, thematically and, you know, but Dawn of the Dead sort of shifted the overall vibe of the original. Zack Snyder very much modernized it in more ways than one. And even the way the zombies moved, that in Dawn of the Dead, they were strong and they ran at you. They were still cannibalistic, wanted to, you know, mow down on you and turn you into a zombie and the whole nine.
Well,
but they were tough and ran and posed a real
threat. One of the things I really, really loved about the Dawn of the Dead remake was what ended up happening in the credits.
Yes.
The opening?
No, the opening credits were totally awesome. Credits were, I felt, just
awesome.
Awesome.
A beautiful,
yeah,
way to.
Yeah, I thought the opening sequence of the Zack Snyder Dawn of the Dead was just the absolutely the most perfect way to set up that story. Even still, like, it kind of gives me chills thinking about it, because it's just this idyllic little suburbia just being torn apart and it's utter chaos. And
dude,
it's,
when she walks out of her house and there's like choppers and smoke, it's
that
like
is
the shit has hit the fan.
Terrifying.
Yeah, just awesome. Because that was one of those cinematic moments where I could really, like, it just hit right. Like, it just looks so feasible. Like, what if that happened? Like, what if you just walked out?
Another movie that was kind of like that, I thought the first, probably third, maybe half of The Crazies. Did y'all see that?
Yeah,
I did.
I thought the first, like, half or so was incredible. The way it just built up to everything going completely wrong.
That one did start strong.
But I thought towards the end it just got okay. I still really liked the movie, but it was just basic.
I sort of found that I didn't really care about the characters.
Yeah, that was my thought. I was just like, okay, and... Wow, I think I'm going to go get an ice cream now. You know, like, I was just...
Like, I dug I dug the horror aspect. I dug, like, you know, the gore and the, you know, the zombie aspect or, like, whatever that... What was it? It was, like,
some
biological...
sort of virus, yeah.
Yeah, like, I dug that, but, yeah, like, as far as, like, character development and, you know, actually having any kind of vested interest
now,
correct
me if I'm wrong, but wasn't that also a remake?
Yeah, it was.
Yes, yeah, of a George Romero film.
Right,
yeah.
Right. No, but wasn't Dawn of the Dead kind of what got the newest wave of interest in zombies kind of kicked off, or was that?
No, I'd say that was 28 days later. Days later was really the, you know, what I would call the modern godfather, if you will.
That's worth looking up. That's interesting, because I don't disagree, but I don't agree. You know what I mean?
Out in 2002. The Zack Snyder remake was 2004. So, I mean, maybe least in America.
I saw 28 Days Later in the theater here. I would say that you could argue that the difference between them is, you know, that they never actually call it a zombie virus in, you know, or anything zombie related in 28 Days Later. You know, it's right. The rage virus.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Dawn of the Dead is very clearly it's a zombie thing that's going on. And so I'd say that 28 Days Later definitely kicked off that kind of the fast moving infected zombie person thing.
Yeah.
And then I would say that Dawn of the Dead kind of brought it into sharp focus, if
you will. And to sort of throw another a view out there as far as 28 is that, like, the whole not viewing it as a zombie thing, I think, is like, I don't want to say split in hairs, but I think most people saw that as like a zombie movie.
It was pretty much referenced as a
zombie film. Because for me, it was sort of a revelation. It was sort of like, well, wait a minute, you know, because I had thought about it as a zombie. You know, I was kind of one of them, whereas like I just kind of considered it because it's zombie. It's got them zombie like properties. It looks, by all means, you know, counts, like, looks zombie-ish, but it,
right.
You know, when you really think about it, it's like, yeah, they don't really want to eat you. They, you know, they kind of, it's more of just a very, very closely related viral sort of situation.
Sure,
absolutely.
But I actually think that when I think about it, I think that might be it. I think that might be the film that sort of brought it back, because before that, the closest thing we had was, like, the Return of the Living Dead sequels, like, you know,
which were
awesome.
Yes.
I mean, like, in a room kind of way. Like, they were just so bad. Oh my God. There was
Send more cops.
That's awesome. That's one of my favorites, man. I love that it was just brains. Like, that was an example where they just sort of deviated with it, and it was awesome. Like, it was just so funny, like, so cool. And, like, I actually saw a funny, like, story really quick. Do you know Paul Reagan, Tall Paul, Tattoos Paul?
Yeah.
Me and him were over at this chick's house on Folly Beach one time. This was like in the mid-90s, and we saw Return of the Living Dead 4 came on.
Mm-hmm.
And it very little to do with any zombie like protocol or anything. But this chick, I remember she's a zombie, but she's still like coherent. And she keeps like piercing herself or hurting herself in some way. I can't remember, but they're like, why are you doing that? And she's like, the pain stops the hunger. Like, she's doing it to like curb her like hunger for flesh or whatever. And, like, that night or a few nights later, I was in Alex's with Paulie. And this was back in the day when there was a restaurant in Mount Pleasant where Paige's Ochre Grill is now. And it was a 24-hour diner called Alex's. And we were in there in the middle of the night, and you would get, like, you know, drunk frat boys and just
the craziest collection
of
Mount people.
Pleasant.
Mr. Wallow and myself are part of the Alex's crew.
Absolutely. And Paulie had a pierced eyebrow, and he went to the bathroom. And we were just drinking coffee. We weren't drunk or anything. But he goes in the bathroom, just, you know, does his business. He's washing his hands. And as he's about to split, this drunk, you know, kind of meatball comes into the bathroom. He's like, whoa, you got a pierced eyebrow, man. What? Did that hurt? And Paul was like, the pain, man. It stops the hunger.
Nice.
That was awesome.
All right. And I think on that note, we're going to go ahead and wrap up this particular episode of The Coneheads Theory. We will see you sometime in the next couple of days.
And also, we just want to say that once we posted the first episode, we started getting a response from people. You know, we appreciate those of you who liked our page just because you like us, and we also appreciate... We especially appreciate those who have taken the time to download and listen to our cast. We appreciate it very much, and we hope you enjoy it, because, you know, no need for us to be here if you're not enjoying it. So Thank you very much, and we look forward to bringing you more Coneheads Theory in the future.
Cool.
Well, you know, and if you're not enjoying it, then, you know, screw you, because I'm having a good time.
Yeah, this is fun. I had a good time today. I thought it was a rad talk. It was interesting to – I just wanted to disclaim that I'm by no means an adept at giving reviews. So, thank you for sitting through the Melancholy review. And hi, Dad.
I think next time I would like to anyway, next time pick up where we left off on the quirky films in Hollywood, because I still have a bit to say on that subject.
Absolutely. Cool.
We will move on from there.
So. Nice.
All right. Once again, thank you very much for listening, and we are the Coneheads Theory. I'm your co-host, Chris Fabian.
I'm Stephen Lacey.
Chris Thomas.
And I'm your moderator, Andrew Wallow. The Coneheads Theory is written and produced by Chris Thomas, Chris Fabian, and Stephen Lacey, and is taped in front of a dead studio audience at the Grove Street Studios in Charleston, South Carolina. The Coneheads Theory is in no way now nor has ever been affiliated with the Nazi Party. We'll see you next week.
Signing off.